Well, pretty much any week you can read articles in the press that can only depress those interested in religion. The one I came across this week was in the Times, headed, "Have you heard the one about the vicar and the organist?" It's comparatively trivial. It's about a book written from the organist's point of view, but it still makes a number of depressing points. Too many clergy use organists as human jukeboxes, demand impossible working hours, difficult and demanding clergy. Relations deteriorate to the point where court action becomes unavoidable. Vicars and organists, it often seems, are doomed to coexist in a state of outright hostility. I'm trying to smile at Noel at the front there, but, you know, sadly there's some truth in it. Vicars have a standard little joke. You know, what's the difference between organists and terrorists? You can negotiate with terrorists. And organists have their standard reply. What's the difference between vicars and terrorists? Terrorists know what they want. I suspect there was actually considerably more serious exploitation in mind in another article I read in a serious journal, trying to analyse the decline in organised religion while at the same time noting the rise in spirituality. Here's what this author wrote. "The major attraction of the word spirituality lies in the fact that it is not religion. People increasingly regard religion as a bad thing. Religion," he went on, "is viewed as some externally imposed worldview and set of practices, requiring conformity on the part of those who buy into it, backed up by narrow-minded attitudes based on dogmatic understandings of the meaning of everything, and all enforced by hierarchical structures that are," listen to this, "riddled with hypocrisy and self-serving in a way that exploits others and prevents them reaching their full potential as human beings." Bono, the lead singer of U2, expressed it like this: "Religion is what is left when the spirit has left the building." Religion, hypocrisy, exploitation. And I guess we need now to add one more ingredient, which is terrorism. For however distorted, there's no denying that religion is a significant force motivating the likes of Al-Qaeda, the terrorist bombers here in London. The widow of one, herself a converted Muslim, this week blamed extremist mosques for turning her husband into a suicide bomber. Religion, hypocrisy, exploitation, terrorism. It's a very modern mix, isn't it? And enough to make anyone wary of religion. As a matter of fact, it's a very ancient mix too. And I'm not just thinking of the shameful incidents in Christian church history. It's actually the mix that is the background to Jesus' words here. The strangers, thieves and robbers he spoke of seem to be both the contemporary religious establishment whom Jesus often fingered for their hypocrisy and their exploitation. And when he speaks in verse 8 of all who came before me and of their stealing and killing and destroying, it's hard not to imagine he had in mind as well those who in very recent years in his time had tapped into the nationalistic fervor, claimed a messianic role, led armed uprisings against the occupying forces and come with their followers to a bloody end. Today, almost certainly, we'd have called it terrorism. So when we read of shepherds, those of us who are townies here tonight, we do need to forget some idyllic rural scene, the straw-sucking one man and his dog ambling along behind the flock, with the dog doing all the real work anyway. That isn't how it was. The shepherd was the out-in-front leader. The shepherd was the guardian and protector of the flock. The shepherd was another word for the leader, the ruler, the king, and the shepherd. Here's the king, the Messiah. When Jesus says, "I am the shepherd," now this is not some sweet, tame figure. You can, if you like, say he's following in the line of terrorists. That was his world. He'd actually die in place of a terrorist, Barabbas. He'd die surrounded by terrorists, thieves who'd murdered for a cause. But actually what Jesus says, when you look at verse 11, is not just I am the shepherd, but I am the good shepherd. And good here, not primarily in contrast, you know, the true one as opposed to the false, though clearly it's got that meaning in this passage, and not even the good one as opposed to the evil one, though that's true as well. No, no, the word's got this connotation. It's really attractive. I'm the attractive shepherd. What is so attractive about Jesus? Well, verse 11 is, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. What's so attractive about Jesus? Well, first of all, surely, as you look at those words, it is the depth of his love. The depth of his love. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. We are a million miles away from the suicide bomber, aren't we? They, fueled by hate, sacrifice themselves to destroy others. Here, fueled by love, he sacrifices himself to protect others. One is an ugly deterrent, the other is powerfully attractive. Self-sacrifice is, isn't it? Do you remember earlier this year the murder of a woman in a Nottingham jeweler's shop? She was gunned down, shielding her daughter. I can't imagine what a cocktail of emotions are probably still racing through that daughter's mind. But one thought she will always be able to hang on to is this, isn't it? As she thinks of her mother, she loved me that much. She loved me that much. I imagine many who heard the story at the time would have been saying sadly, wistfully to themselves, I can't think of anyone who'd love me that much. Well, here's one. And he's not just anyone. Now, this is the shepherd. There's a famous chapter in the Old Testament scriptures where God denounces the shepherds, the leaders of his people, too busy fleecing their position for its privileges, lining their own pockets to care for the people. Shepherds who frankly looked at some fairly scraggy sheep and didn't think they were worth bothering about. And God promises in that chapter that one day he will come and do the job properly himself. Well, here he is. I am the good shepherd, says Jesus. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Yeah, there's a side of nearly all of us, isn't it, that is actually very concerned to be valued. We want to be of worth. We want to have some right importance. Lots of energies sometimes go into it, don't they, in people's lives. Relationships that are coveted or jealously clung to. Careers pursued, status striven for and absorbing us. If you recognize yourself in that at all, put alongside those thoughts these words for a leader. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. God's king pays out his life for his people. I can't be worth more than that, can I? He can't be more for us than that, can he? I love you cannot be taken to greater lengths than that, can it? I mean, who doesn't want that quality in their leader? There is something deeply attractive in self-sacrifice. Catch a glimpse of it in real life. You know, see it on a film. And it gets you. Remember Captain Corelli's mandolin? And that scene towards the end of the film, the Italians have joined the Allies at the end of the war, and now Italian soldiers have been rounded up and the Germans are putting them in front of a firing squad. They're all rather casually, because it's a very laid-back whole scenario, they're all casually there as the Germans start to open fire. And in the novel, this is how it's described. What no one had seen was that at the order to fire, Carlo had stepped smartly sideways like a soldier forming ranks. Antonio Corelli, in a haze of nostalgia and forgetfulness, had found in front of him the titanic bulk of Carlo Guercio, had found his wrists gripped painfully in those mighty fists, had found himself unable to move, and Carlo stood unbroken as one bullet after another burrowed like white-hot parasitic knives into the muscles of his chest. Eventually, Carlo flung himself over backwards, and Corelli lay beneath him, paralyzed by his weight, drenched utterly in his blood, stupefied by, listen to how he describes it, an act of love so incomprehensible, so filled with divine madness. An act of love so incomprehensible, so filled with divine madness. That kind of self-sacrifice is immensely attractive. But actually, when you consider how attractive it is, remarkably rare. I am the good shepherd, he says, verse 11. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And look how he goes on. The hired hand now is not the shepherd who owns the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. And then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. And you notice when Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep, it's not an offer limited to attractive sheep, you know, just the best of flock. If I am asking why me, there's no point in looking inside for the answer. It lies with his deeply attractive love. There's Jesus living in a world with more than its fair share of violence. And he says, I am the good shepherd. And you say, what do you mean? And he says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. What's so attractive about Jesus? The depth of his love. Here's something else. I don't really know how to put it, really. The best I've come up with this is the realism of his love. The realism of his love. What I'm meaning is that when Jesus says this, it is more than talk, and it's more than a gesture. It's more than tokenism here. He may be talking of love, but we are definitely not in the world of slush, are we? He speaks of life in verse 10. He links it to death in verse 11. But this is not to others die so that he lives. It's he dies so that others live. Now we can line Jesus up alongside terrorists if we like, but make sure you notice this leader comes not carrying a Kalashnikov, but a cross. And that's where his story leads. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. But they're more than mere words. And the cross is the ultimate reminder of the realism with which Jesus speaks. There is a wolf. That is the reality of life. He doesn't lay down his life just for fun. I spent my early years without a Christian faith. And when I started student life, as many of you are no doubt doing at the moment, I was one of those happy-go-lucky types who was reasonably lucky, so I was very happy. And I'd have said, well, you know, it's how it goes. I'd have said, look, if someone had asked me, I don't need a shepherd. I mean, looking back, I'm not sure what embarrasses me more, my blindness or my arrogance. My blindness to imagine there was no threat, or my arrogance to imagine that I could handle it. I mean, only particularly stupid sheep really think they can take on a wolf and win. There are many different points in life that wake people up to their need of a shepherd, aren't there? For some, it can be some of those ugly family relationship moments. For others, it can be work-related. For some, it's health, but if we've spent any time despising God and the Christian thing, one of the most stunning discoveries for us is when we find that Jesus is more in touch with reality than we are. And here's the wolf we will all face. Death. At death's door, we all need a shepherd. And it's worth having one who faces reality. I don't know what ism is shepherding you along. I mean, you know, you don't want to be holding the hand of materialism when you face death. Whatever shape or form your materialism is, whether it's things or status or career or qualifications, when you face the wolf of death, you suddenly discover materialism's run away. It has no impact whatsoever. You don't want to be facing... You don't want to be holding the hand of relativism as a shepherd when you face death. The wolf of death laughs at the idea of relativism. He'll tell you there's only one law here. It's the law of the jungle. I eat anything in front of me. Or whatever truth you think is the truth for you. And you don't want to be holding the hand of the shepherd of romanticism when you face the wolf of death. I mean, as a minister, I've taken a number of funerals. I can remember one very vividly. Family distraught, quite understandably. It was a son in his 30s who died, tragically. And as we were talking before the funeral, they asked me, they said, could we have this poem read at the funeral? They showed me the poem. Its opening lines went like this: death is nothing, absolutely nothing at all. And I looked at them. I'm just grief all over, the tears are still on the cheeks. And I looked at the poem. I said, why are you crying? And they looked at me. I said, look, if death is nothing, absolutely nothing at all, why the grief? I said, wouldn't we be better finding a shepherd who'd faced the reality? The reality you're feeling, death is an enemy. Someone who can face that reality and still help. Yeah, when death comes knocking at my door, this is the shepherd I want. The one who knows it, who's laid down his life for the sheep. But you notice when you come to verse 17, he not only lays down his life, he takes it up again. The story doesn't end at the cross, but the resurrection, he's blazed the trail. He can lead me through death to life in all its fullness. And the sting of death, of course, is sin. And the judgment it brings. I'm powerless in the face of it, and so are you. But here's the shepherd who on the cross took that judgment for me. Faced all the powers of evil that we ought to suffer to protect us. It's as if on the cross Jesus looks at sin, at its ultimate consequences, at evil and all it would inflict, and looks at us in our weaknesses and throws himself between and says, over my dead body. Like Carlo for Captain Corelli. No, of course, it's the other way round, isn't it? That's just the fiction, the novel. And as de Bernier wrote it, he's deliberately echoing the fact, the reality that is the cross. Petya saw something of that, didn't she? Made aware of her sins. And when I asked her a few days ago, what was so attractive about Jesus as you began to examine him and study him, she said, I was just stunned by his love. This kind of love. It means the only way you can get to hell is over his dead body. If I'll trample on, ignore the shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. When the wolf of death and judgment comes knocking at my door, this is the shepherd I want. The shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep, who draws the sting of death and takes it for me. Can you think of a shepherd you'd rather have? I mean, you wouldn't be so foolish as to think of taking that wolf on by yourself, would you? And of course, the shepherd I can trust for then is the shepherd to trust for now. The one who's proved himself for me on the cross is the one who, whatever the appearances, has come that we may have life and have it to the full. They're rerunning one of the reality TV shows at the moment. It's called The Monastery. They took hold of five men and made them spend 40 days in a monastery in Sussex. By all accounts, it is actually one of the few reality TV shows that's got anything to make it worth watching in. One of the characters they put in there was a man called Tony. Tony works in advertising in the soft porn industry. And it was fascinating to watch Tony over the weeks. He began facing the wolf and happily laughing. He might be a sinner, but he said, I'm a very happy sinner. And then by week three, he's saying, I really want to get this. And by the end, when a couple of the other characters in the monastery have a blazing row, it's Tony who acts as the peacemaker. And he describes the monastery, he says, as the most forgiving place on the planet. Fascinating. It's as if Tony had tasted some of the attractiveness of the Good Shepherd who laid down his life for the soft porn merchant. As if he was bitten by the hardcore realism of this love. What's so attractive about Jesus? The depth of his love. The realism of his love. There's one other question we've got to ask tonight, though. It's just implied all the way through this passage, and it's this: what's our response to Jesus? What's our response to Jesus? I mean, we do live in a messy world, and religion is not exempt, and yes, religion and hypocrisy and exploitation and terrorism, too often they become a sordid mix, which is enough to deter anyone. And the temptation is to shrug and say, what chance do I stand of sorting it out? And you could forgive me for turning my back on it all. And yet as I read what Jesus says here, I find him saying that's not actually the way it goes. See, it isn't just that the reality of sheep and shepherd and wolf is etched deep into every life. Did you notice, as Stuart read to us, the little lines that kept coming in, it's there in verse 3, the sheep listen to his voice. It's there again in verse 4, the sheep follow him because they know his voice. Or he puts it in the negative in the next verse, they won't follow a stranger because they don't recognize a stranger's voice. It says it again in verse 8 about the thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. By verse 14, he's making the point another way, isn't he? I am the good shepherd, he says. I know my sheep. I mean, try and take it in. God's king knows his people. Knows me, knows you. If you were down the Mall one day, and the Queen was driving home in her Rolls or whatever, you know, doing the wave. And as she was coming close to you, you saw her just tap the chauffeur, and the whole thing slows down, and the window's coming down. And you look along the Mall, and you see I'm just in front of you. And she sort of leans out and waves and says, hello, Hugh, how's it going at All Souls? I mean, you'd be impressed, wouldn't you? I'd be very impressed. I mean, if I may say so, I suspect Her Majesty would be pretty impressed if she could pull that off. We've never met. But God's King of all the world knows his sheep. I've always been haunted by an evocative line that Boris Pasternak once wrote in Dr. Zhivago. He described people like this: nameless numbers in a file long since mislaid. What a powerful way to speak of insignificance and meaninglessness. If you ever get overwhelmed by the thought that that's you, try putting it alongside this staggering truth. God's King says to you, I know my sheep. Yes, but notice how it goes on, verse 14. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Don't tell me he's speaking in a very Jewish context. He is, but it's not restricted to that. By the time you get to verse 16, he's saying, no, I've got to go elsewhere. There are other sheep that also belong, and I must bring them as well. And they too will listen to my voice. I know my sheep and my sheep know me. Is that you? I'm not asking what's your response to religion. I'm asking what's your response to Jesus? An intimate relationship between shepherd and sheep, God and his people. Do you know what it is to be on speaking terms with the living God? Regular speaking terms. If it were to come to the judgment day and the great throne, and we queued up, we Brits can do queuing very well, and you get to the front and it's face to face with Almighty God, would he be saying to you, good to see you, old friend? Would he be looking at you and saying, I never knew you. I never knew you. I never knew you. Because if that's the case, wouldn't this be a great day to become friends with the living God? What's so attractive about Jesus? Friends, that is a record of history. Nothing will change that. The depth and realism of his love. What's our response to Jesus? That's history in the making. That's tonight's issue. See, as you listen to the shepherd, as you hear his call, as you glimpse something, hear a little of him tonight, how do you respond? You'll notice as you come to the end of the little passage we were reading, as you reach verse 19, it divided his listeners in two. At these words, the Jews were again divided, and many of them said, he's demon-possessed and raving mad, why listen to him? Is that where you're at tonight? You just think, look, why listen to this Jesus? In fact, as soon as this thing ends, I'm going to just make sure my neighbor knows, don't listen to Jesus. In just a moment, we're just going to have a minute's silence, a minute in which we can think on what Jesus says. We can tell God what we think of Jesus. Will that be what you'll say? Why listen to him? Or would you be like the others in verse 21? These aren't the sayings of a man possessed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Not why listen to him, but he is the one worth listening to. If that's you, you couldn't do better than to come along to that Christianity Explored course. As you've heard, it's tailor-made for someone saying, this is the shepherd to check out. If you're a student tonight, starting a student career, faced with a whole barrage of choices that everyone throws at students in your first week, let me tell you, there is no issue you would be better sorting out than, is this the one to listen to? And you say, look, I can't wait for some course to do it. It's time this shepherd became my shepherd. Well, have a word with me at the end. I'll be at the back of the stairs. I've got a little booklet that might help you do just that. It's entitled, Me, a Christian. Just ask me for it, and I'll give you one. Hey, but before we get there, before we stand and sing our final hymn, now let's face up again to what we've been hearing tonight. Let's just have this minute of silence, this minute for you to tell God how you respond to Jesus. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Why listen to Jesus? He's the one worth listening to. I need him as my good shepherd. Let's be quiet.